open. One more tug and Mikkel relented, hanging his head.
The Sith build their homes over the best of what remains in the corridor. The Emperors themselves built their palace above the Ark, and bind the Academy to them with its power. We pay explorers to hunt beneath the ice.
My father?
Your father sold my predecessor much of what we keep here.
Nona blinked, and in her moment of surprise the preacher pulled the door free and slammed it between them. Nona turned slowly from the doorway. The wind came laced with a cold rain. A graveyard lay before her, scores of headstones black in the moonless night. Her mother was dead, her bones buried, waiting for the hope. They would never speak again. Nona would never ask whether her mother truly sent her child away to save her from Shirzal's revenge. She felt nothing, only an emptiness that reached up from her chest to constrict her throat. She stumbled between the headstones, dazed, trembling with a hurt that had no center to it.
Where are we going? You said you'd kill someone. That was the deal when I helped you win your game with the tree and the box.
Nona straightened. The headstones were thinning out now, the ground overgrown with bramble. A few buildings lay ahead, lights at their windows, more behind them, their number building rapidly towards the town. The hurt and loss that had taken her breath contracted into a tight ball of rage. I am going to kill someone. She spoke it to the night and to the dead. Perhaps a lot of people.
Yisht, is she first? How will you find her?
I'm going to Shirzal's palace, and when I leave the Emperor will only have one sister living. Something punched Nona in the shoulder. She turned and stared back into the darkness of the graveyard, trying to find her opponent. Her fingers discovered something like a narrow stick standing proud from her coat, and she yanked it clear. A black shaft similar to Giljan's, but thinner. Another hit her just below the collarbone. Too late, Nona dived for cover behind the nearest headstone. She could feel a stiffness in her muscles already. Lockup. The same toxin that Clara had jabbed her with on the day they parted company.
Did you see them?
Kiot asked.
No.
The attacker had to be close. The darts couldn't be fired more than 30 yards with any accuracy. But Nona hadn't seen anything save blackness and hints of the graveyard.
I can't stay here. I need to kill them while I can still move.
Was it the preacher? Or had Giljan followed her for a second bite at the 100 sovereigns? If she were properly prepared, she would have a dozen antidotes in her habit. But she had fled the convent, empty-handed.
Help me see!
Kiot needed no encouragement. He poured into her eyes, and when the burning sensation dulled enough for her to unscrew them, Nona saw a world on fire. She gathered herself, ready to spring. Belatedly, she pulled out the second dart and stared at the yellow line of it for a moment, trying to focus her thoughts. They refused to order themselves.
Something different on this one. Groton?
Was it really Giljan again, after she had spared him? With an oath, Nona flung herself from cover, the graveyard revealing itself in shades of orange. She could see no attacker, only a clot of darkness beside one of the larger tombs sporting a winged hope.
Darkness?
Kiot saw through darkness. A third dart came hissing towards her out of that impenetrable inkiness. This one, at least, she could see. She reached for it with the remnants of her quickness, muscles screaming in protest. Darla had once described her father coming home drunk from a military banquet. Nona felt as if she were reenacting Darla's mimicry of her father's uncoordinated stagger. The dart slipped past her grasping fingers and sunk into her flesh just above her left hip bone.
Oh!
And she pitched forward into her own midnight. Chapter 25. Abbess Glass. With Sister Kettle gone from the convent, Abbess Glass had to rely more heavily on Mistress Shade's network of grey novices for information on the Inquisitor's activities. Apple used her most trusted and promising candidates for the Grey to observe Brother Pelter and his watchers. However well trained the Inquisitors might be, nobody knew the convent better than the novices who grew up there, and it was easy enough to keep an open ear in most corners.
"Here comes trouble."
Glass watched Sister Spire across the square, habit flapping around her legs, her walk close enough to a run that it might be called either. The abbess's window comprised a dozen panes of puddle glass, their unevenness lending a flowing quality to the nun's approach. Sister Spire vanished around the corner of the building, and Glass went to her desk to wait. The knock came a minute later, evidence of Spire's urgency.
"Come?"
The mistress of mystic class hurried in, her blunt face flushed, headdress tugged down across her forehead, almost hiding the puckered burn there. Glass had discovered that the young nun had earned her scars carrying children clear of a house fire. The information had arrived the previous week, in Archon Cratton's report on the mission to the Melar territory. Spire had spoken of the blaze when asked, but made no mention of returning for children.
"Ancestors' blessings, Abbess."
"And to you, sister."
"Novice Zole is missing."
Spire blurted out the words as if it were her failing.
"I see." Glass folded her hands, elbows on the desk. "Do we know where she might have gone?"
Spire shook her head.
"She's taken her ranging equipment. Nobody saw her leave. One of the watchers asked me where she was this morning."
"Well, if the Inquisition didn't manage to watch her, I doubt there was much you could have done, sister."
Spire pursed her lips.
"You don't seem very surprised, Abbess."
"I'm surprised that she stayed this long."
"You expected this? You think she's safe, then?"
"Safe? I doubt that very much. But she's a dangerous young woman. I'm sure she'll make a good account of herself when trouble gets in her way."
"Well, I'm surprised. Zole was making such fine progress with all the mistresses, even Sister Wheel. And she seemed very happy to have your permission for the ice trial. Well, happy for Zole. She even smiled when I told her."
"That I would like to have seen."
Glass picked up the papers before her, then looked up.
"Is there anything else, sister?"
Spire looked surprised.
"Well, aren't we going to do something? We could send someone after her. Sister Needle, has just taken the Grey. She could..."
Spire hugged her arms across her chest.
"I just hate to think of her out there all alone. I know they say she's the chosen one, but she's still just a girl."
"There are many girls out there all alone, Spire. The Empire is awash with children, lost, abandoned, orphaned. We will tell Brother Pelter. I'm sure he'll know soon enough either way. Doubtless he'll be keen to send agents of the Inquisition after Novice Zole."
Spire nodded, turned to go, paused, and opened her mouth as if to speak, then closed it and left. Night fell before they came. Sister Tallow preceded them, bursting into the abbess's office without knocking.
"Pelter's at the door! He has his guards with him!"
"You're to allow him to go about his business, Tallow."
Tallow's eyes darkened at that.
"They can only take you if you let them."
She looked old, too thin, her habit loose around her, iron in the black of her hair now, but Glass knew what she was capable of.
"Just speak the word,"
to set any nun in this convent against the church, in my own defense, would confirm the worst suspicions whispered into the Emperor's ear. If I were to use the red and the grey as my personal army, it would only encourage Crucicle to take them for his own.
Glass remained in her seat, watching the door. She knew how the Inquisition worked. Once it had been hers. Old Devis, the man who had recruited her as a watcher, had been 10 years a watcher himself, then 15 as an inquisitor. After Shella Yamal came to work for him, Devis's star rose swiftly. He rode her shoulders to the deputy's chair before she jumped him to become High Inquisitor with Devis as her second. Had Abel not died, she would still be there, watching the world from the highest room in the Tower of Inquiry. But the loss of a child tears something from any parent. Often what is ripped from a mother's chest leaves her broken, a husk waiting to be gathered to the ancestor. Always it will change her. But sometimes the person who sets aside their mourning blacks is a better one. 3 knocks at the door. Sharp. Precise.
Come.
Glass knew a moment of fear. She had seen the horrors of the Inquisition up close. Nothing is as cruel as a righteous man. She had been righteous in her time. Brother Pelter strode in, 2 Inquisition guards clattering at his shoulders, 3 more behind them, all gleaming in their armor, polished steel plates overlapping from neck to elbow.
Brother Pelter, how may I help you today?
Glass returned her quill to its holder and stoppered her ink.
Abbess Glass, I'm placing you under church arrest on the charge of heresy. You're to be taken to the Tower of Inquiry for interrogation.
Heresy? Glass pursed her lips.
Am I allowed a little more detail? I've told you the charge.
Pelter waved his guards on, and they advanced around him.
I would like to hear more.
Sister Tallow stepped into their path. At her hip, she wore her sword, a cruel strip of arc steel. Pelter's guards stopped. They might be hard-bitten and well-used to violence. The woman on the right had a gerund touch and stood well over 6 foot, broad-shouldered with it. But all of them had heard of Mistress Blade at Sweet Mercy.
There are questions to be asked and answered, Sister Tallow. Asked and answered in the Tower of Inquiry, a place that admits no lies.
Brother Pelter stepped back to open the door.
A novice under sentence of death ran from the convent within minutes of that decision being reached at the convent table. That's hardly heresy, Tallow spat. Holding any law above that of the ancestor is heretical, and the novice had been encouraged to write in praise of past heretics, whose histories have no place in any convent library.
Pelter waved the matter away.
More importantly, Abbess Glass placed her authority over that of the parent. Zoe Lancis was to be sent to the ice against her parents' express instruction, expressed, I may say, through a judge of Verity's highest court.
He turned his gaze from Tallow towards Glass.
And now the child has gone missing. An absence I suspect you to have arranged in order to keep your heretical control over someone you consider politically important at this time of heightened tension. The bonds of family form the branches of the ancestors' tree. No cleric can take to themselves the authority to overrule a parent. Such practice is an abomination before the ancestor, a crime worthy of the Skithrol.
Step aside, Tallow. The abbess stood.
You're to let Brother Pelter carry out his duty and arrest me.
She raised her wrists. The guards stepped forward, the oldest of them taking a symbolic silver chain from his belt and using it to bind the abbess's wrists.
Abbess Glass!
Pelter stepped forward now with his warrant scroll.
You are a prisoner of the Inquisition. Come with me.
Let the sisters know, Tallow. Glass came around her desk, dwarfed by the guards around her. And of course the Marshal sisters and sisters of discretion will need to take action if I am questioned in the Tower of Inquiry. Sister Tallow frowned.
But you just said... Ignore that, sister.
Pelter cut across her.
Clerics of the rank of abbess, abbot, or above are entitled to refuse questioning in Inquisition outposts, and indeed in most other locations. But the Tower of Inquiry is sanctified and sanctioned to put any cleric to question, even the High Priest himself. Abbess Glass needs to improve her research.
Abbess Glass shook her head. A High Inquisitor, former or current, may not be put to question on Inquisition property. It's an old ruling passed after a succession of High Inquisitors were removed from office following interrogation by their deputies. It appeared to be used as a form of self-promotion. Fortunately, the former was added to the ruling in order to defend past office holders such as myself from having the Inquisition used against them to settle old debts. And as an abbess, I am of course subject to church law rather than secular law, so the judge's courts are not a fit place either. Pelter, wrong-footed, began to bluster.
Where, pray tell, can an individual such as yourself be made to answer to heresy? You don't expect me to believe there's no place fit to host so eminent a person?
Of course not. The abbess smiled. Take me to the Emperor's palace.
I'm taking you off this rock, that's for sure.
Pelter snarled. He waved the guards forward. Have the sisters watch from a discreet distance, Tallow dear. Glass called over her shoulder as they led her out. The Inquisitor and his guards ushered the abbess down the stairs and along her own entrance hall to her front door. Glass drew a deep breath, preparing to face the day. Many at the convent had seen her paraded in an iron yoke by their own high priest. As humiliations went, the silver chains of the Inquisition were not the worst. She stood while the guards tied her outdoor robes around her shoulders. If Pelter took her to the Emperor's palace, it wouldn't guarantee Glass's safety. But there was no place within those walls that rumor would not spread from. Rather than have Shirzal hand him both a confession and control of the convent, along with an excuse, perhaps, to seize any monastery he liked, Crucicle would have the whole business unfold under his own roof, before the disapproval of the High Priest and the Archons, before the Sis and the Academy. To Glass's knowledge, Crucicle wasn't even aware what was happening. It was one thing to grumble about not having the red and the grey answer your every whim. Quite a different thing to wield the Inquisition as a political knife to carve out what you wanted. The latter required a stomach for blood. Lots of blood. Chapter 26. In the black and rolling confusion into which Nona woke, she found nothing to hold on to. Her limbs refused to obey. Her eyes found nothing to see. Kiot's words were distant, muted beyond understanding. The world moved and creaked and jolted and swayed around her. Something contained her. A box? And she was in motion, captive and being taken somewhere? Nona discovered herself unable to form sentences or coherent thoughts. Everything swirled around in her mind with nothing constant. When in all that shifting chaos, she stumbled upon a way out, she took it. Nona left the maelstrom of her poisoned thoughts to sit mute and watchful in the quiet place into which she had fallen. The eyes through which she gazed were not hers, and looked where they wanted to, but they were sharp enough.
"I've done this before."
Nobody answered, though she could feel another's thoughts all around her, pulsing back and forth between memories. Some thoughts spiraled towards action, others were discarded and began to fade.
"I'm inside Kettle. We're thread-bound."
Nona watched a disjointed series of images roll past. Scenes from the Seren Way, nightfall in a forest, roads thick with travelers, wagons and cart queuing at a bridge, sunrise over a river, watched from the prow of a boat. While she tried to make sense of it, Nona reached for the memories closest at hand, letting them run through her. It seemed that the memories around her were about her. Reading lessons in the scriptorium, the day she arrived and Sister Apple made her wash in the bathhouse, how small and skinny she had been, the sight of herself jumping from one loop of the blade path to the next, scores of others. Nona took another memory, this one feeling fresher, still buzzing with energy. It jolted into her, filling her mind with sound and light.
"Kettle? Kettle, are you even listening to me?"
Kettle sat up, holding the sheet to her against the cold of the undercaves. Apple stood above her, a pewter cup in one hand, salt-glazed flask of the convent red in the other.
"What? Did you want any more wine?"
Kettle glanced up at Apple in her nightdress, red hair unbound and coiled around her shoulders. A moment later it was all gone, Apple, the bed, the cave, and Kettle was reliving Nona's fight in the graveyard at White Lake. The shock of the attack had drawn Kettle along their thread bond to experience it with Nona. Nona discarded Kettle's memory of the attack before the third dart that had brought her down. She worried that if she let it, the memory would drag her back into the darkness and confusion she had so recently escaped. Nona left Kettle's memories alone, feeling guilty for trespassing, both nervous and intrigued about what she might accidentally happen upon. Instead, she concentrated on what the nun was looking at now. Concentrating inside Kettle's mind was easy, as if somehow Nona had left behind the poisons that kept her prisoner, wherever her body was. A boat. Kettle was on a boat, watching the bank pass by. Bushes, stunted trees, fields beyond, low hills rising, the line of the ice in the distance, a white underscore beneath the clouds, so faint it could be imagination and nothing more.
"Nona!"
Kettle's voice, but Nona could hear the thought too, directed at her, where she lurked in the darkness behind Kettle's eyes. Nona tried to answer but found herself mute, perhaps not as free of the poisons as she thought. Allowed to watch through Kettle, a passive passenger, but unable to take any action or speak with a voice of her own. Kettle frowned. She knew something had changed. The bond that Nona had made between them was not something she understood, but it was something she could follow. Kettle had been trying to shadow bond when Nona had taken over and thread-bound them. Some element of the shadow bond had become woven in, and shadow bonds were something Kettle could follow. She had shadow bonds with Apple, with Betna, whom she must learn to call Sister Needle, and with Sister Frost. Kettle's bond with Saphira had been cut years ago, the severing more painful than the knife that Saphira had stuck her with. But no shadow bond is ever truly broken. Since Apple had pushed her into the dark, Kettle had started to hear whispers along that old bond with her former bedmate, hints of emotion, tugs of wanting.
"Nona?"
she asked again. Nothing. But she felt the girl's presence.
Be strong, Nona. I'm coming for you.
Kettle glanced upstream. The river had been narrowing all morning, and the first hint of rapids foamed white in the distance. The boat she had hired wouldn't get much further. Part of her regretted not disembarking at Feverton that morning. But with the corridor wind filling the sail, the skiff could eat up the miles faster than the alternatives, even heading upstream.
Here! Stop here!
The River Ganymede fed the swirl, which in turn emptied into White Lake. Kettle had learned nothing in the town that she had not already seen when the sharpness of Nona's fear had torn open the bond between them, channeling her experience into Kettle's mind. It had been a revelation, far more intimate a connection than the shadow bond. Kettle pressed her lips together and hoped that details of her own private life had not been slipping back along the bond into Nona's mind without her knowledge. She pointed to a shingle beach at the outer curve of the river. The Ganymede had been angling away from the route she needed to take for some miles now.
"Right you are, sister."
The fisherman and his girl set to grounding their craft.
"Ancestors' blessings on your journey."
The girl brought a loaf and cheese bound with cloth out of a wooden box at the stern.
"And upon your family."
Kettle took the food with a smile and vaulted out onto the stones.
"Safe return."
A wave and she was hurrying up towards the track that paralleled the river. Kettle hunched her coat around her. Not the range coat of a nun, just the weathered garb of a traveller. As she walked, her fingers counted through the vials in their straps against the coat's inner lining. Poisons on one side, antidotes on the other. She checked her weapons from sword and throwing stars to the smallest knife and envenomed pin. Her eyes stayed on what lay ahead. She kept her mind empty of worry and of speculation. She had already considered who might have taken the girl and reached no firm conclusion. To dwell on things, to circle them over and over on the road as she might at the convent, was to invite death. The Grey Sister lives in the now. Thinking ahead was something to make space for, to do in as safe a space as possible, not something that would push you away from the moment. Whoever had taken Nona could easily have covered their back trail, left a friend or two watching them from the boughs of a tree, or beside the road, or standing behind the counter of a pastry stall in some market town, just waiting for someone to kill. Kettle walked from before noon until late into the night, pushing her body to maintain a fierce pace.
"I'll find you, Nona. I swear it to the ancestor. I'll find you and make an end of anyone who seeks to stop me."
Images of cut flesh swarmed forward from a score of memories, quickly pushed back into their places as Kettle focused on the road ahead. A moment's lapse, and she centered herself in the now once again, watchful, taut, ready. The nun slept that night in a farmhouse not far from Honor. A clipped halfpenny proved adequate compensation for rousing the tenants and bought her a room, a bed with fresh linen, plus a meal with meat and mead into the bargain. With her body fueled, Kettle took to her chamber and set her traps. Finally, she arranged the bolster under the sheets, then curled beneath her grey cloak, settling to sleep in the corner the door would obscure if opened. A little later, when the focus moon turned the blackness of her shutters into narrow bars of blazing crimson, Kettle felt Apple's pulse along their shadow bond. Kettle sent her own pulse beating back to Sweet Mercy, letting Mistress Shade know that she was safe. Nona stayed watching, even when Kettle closed her eyes. She didn't want to retreat into her own darkness, to the confusion and nausea, the blindness and the pain. And yet, as the stuff of Kettle's dreams began to rise around her, Nona released her hold on the nun's mind. "For though we may share some dreams, others we don't speak of, even to ourselves. And no one should look that deeply into another person without permission. Maybe
Not even then. Kettle's dream rose red, curling around her. And Nona fell, loosening her grip, dropping away into the chaos of her own mind. Chapter 27. Nona rolled across rough planks and fetched up against a wooden wall. Everything swayed. Everything heaved.
A box. I'm in a box.
The darkness stank of her own waste. Her mouth tasted vomit sour. Light leaked in between the planks, razors against her eyes. Without instruction, her body rolled the other way, one rotation before another wall stopped her. Someone had bound her hands behind her back.
I'm at sea.
You're being carried.
Keot sounded deeply annoyed.
What?
Nona tried to sit up and banged her forehead against the planking just inches above her face.
You're being carried in a small box. You've been in it for 2 days.
Nona screwed her eyes shut and tried to see the path. Nothing. She flexed her arms and gasped at the agony flooding up them. She couldn't feel her hands, though everything else from her shoulders down screamed in protest. Her wrists seemed to be chained together. She tried to will her floor blades into existence, but whether anything happened, she couldn't tell. The light dimmed and Nona heard footsteps on stone, the sound of the people carrying her box, several of them. The noise had an echoing quality. Nona felt herself slipping away into the darkness again. She ground her teeth against the drugs, their poison rising through her like nausea.
I'll kill them, every last one.
That's the first reasonable thing you've said.
Keot's voice followed her into the muffling blackness.
Perhaps ever.
Nona cracked open her eyes an unknown length of time later. They had her on her belly, two of them at least, in a dimly lit room. One was clasping some kind of collar around her neck, the other putting restraints on her ankles. Nona twisted her head as fast as she could, lunging to take a bite of the nearest wrist. But her teeth snapped shut on nothing, the hand withdrawn too swiftly. Another hand pressed her head to the hard floor with an awful pressure, and the first person returned to fixing the collar.
It is done.
A soft voice, without urgency. Someone knelt on Nona's back, struggling with something. A sudden snap and a rattle of chain. Nona's arms slid to her sides, lifeless, but no longer bound together at the wrists. The three of them retreated a few paces. Nona tried to rise, but her arms hung limp, the pain of returning circulation just beginning as pins and needles running down her veins. The first bucket of water took her by surprise, ice cold and sudden. She hauled breath back into her near-paralyzed lungs and had begun to curse when the second bucket hit her with the third, a fraction behind it. Somewhere in the middle of it all, it occurred to her that she was naked.
Roll over.
The same soft voice, empty of mockery or compassion. Nona lay where she was, shivering around her pain. She didn't think she could roll even if she wanted to. One of the shadowy figures approached, bending low. Nona willed her blades into being to lash at the person's leg. But all that happened was that her arm flopped out from her side. Her captor stepped over it and, seizing her opposite shoulder, rolled Nona onto her back. The figure stepped away again and several more buckets of icy water followed. When the last one had been thrown and Nona's spluttering had calmed, she could hear the water gurgling away down a nearby drain.
Stand.
Nona tried. With minimal help from her arms and unbalanced by waves of nausea and confusion, she ended up pitching to one side while still on her knees and lay there shivering uncontrollably. Two of her captors pulled her to her feet. Both were dressed in grey robes with long sleeves, their hair shaved to a finger's width. Nona found it hard to guess their age or sex. Perhaps the one to the left was a woman. Perhaps the one to the right, a man. Neither of them young, but neither old yet. The third approached with a white linen smock that they worked to get Nona into. She noticed, as they did it, that she had metal bands around her wrists, her ankles too, presumably matching the collar at her throat. Nona shook her arms, trying to get more life into them. She couldn't see much of the chamber. The only light filtered in through a barred window in the door. From what hints the gloom offered, the room seemed to be fairly small and bare. Maybe a washroom. For people who had gone to great lengths to abduct her and keep her incapacitated, Nona's captors didn't seem to be particularly wary. She puzzled. They must know of her pathwalking, and likely they would know of her blades too. If they had taken the trouble to find her, they would have taken the trouble to find out about her first. Come. The tallest of the three walked to the door, knocked, and led through when it opened. Nona followed, flanked, and occasionally supported by the other two. A fourth person, similarly shaven-headed and robed, waited in the corridor and joined the escort. Nona supposed they knew how the drugs must still be affecting her, and thus felt safe enough from any display of violence on her part. Single candles burned at irregular intervals in niches along the corridor, just bright enough so that at the darkest spots a hint of the surroundings could still be seen. The doors that they passed looked like cell doors, heavy, each set with a small barred window and a large iron lock. Nona gave silent thanks to Hesse for showing her how to deal with those. Mistress Shade taught classes on overcoming the various mechanisms with a dozen curiously shaped picks or a vial of acid. But Nona had never fared too well at these, perhaps lacking the motivation of those who can't open a lock by pulling its thread. A sewer stench hung around the corridor. Nona knew that she had smelled worse before they sluiced her. The stink put her in mind of Harrison Jail, whose bars she hadn't thought of in an age. Smells will do that for you, reach out and pull you back across the years. She remembered being walked along to the cells with Saida, two little girls, only one of whom would come out again with her neck unbroken. Here, the woman at the front. Nona was sure she was female now. Stopped at a door no different to the previous half-dozen. A key appeared from the woman's robes, and once the door stood open, she led the way inside. In the blackness against the back wall, somehow the woman found a chain and locked the clasp at its end into the cuff around Nona's ankle. Nona considered kicking her in the head and making a break for it, but she still felt weak and ill. Better to escape in private later. Her four captives left without further words, locking the door behind them. Nona supposed that at least one of them must be a martial touch with some shadow-weaving skill in order to perform their task in such gloom.
You're in trouble.
Kiot moved across her collarbones, stinging like an old scald. First I need to get this chain off. Nona tried to force her flaw blades into being, but nothing happened.
Bleed me. Try later. Unless you can do something to clean this muck out of my blood.
It won't make any difference. The collar and the bands are sigil-worked. I can't move under them. They must be to disrupt your abilities, such as they are.
Hells.
Nona felt the metal cuffs around her wrists. The sensation in her fingers had returned. The cuffs were heavy pieces of metal, hinged, locked, smooth except for where the sigils had been engraved in deep, swirling lines. Sister Pan had told her that to permanently imprint power into a sigil was an act that required far more than just marking the correct symbol. A Marshal Fullblood would have to train at the task for half a lifetime, and even after such training, the setting of a single sigil could take anything from hours to days, months, for the most potent sigils. Sigil-marked armor and swords lay beyond the pockets of even many of the Sis. Such things were passed from lord to heir as treasures of the house.
"If I get out of here, wearing these, I'll be richer than Joelle Namsis."
Nona leaned back against the wall, finding it cold and uncomfortable. Her body appeared to be made entirely from aches connected by pains. She retched, then gathered her will and tried to find the path. Her eyes saw nothing but darkness. She tried to defocus her vision, to look past the world to the network of threads that underlie all things, including darkness. Again, nothing.
"I'm going to have to do this the hard way."
The bravado was for any ears that might be listening. It was also a lie.
"A lonely trail, sister. Are you lost?"
The man stepped into the path from the tree line, and Kettle's heart rate doubled from one beat to the next. In a dark cell miles from the forested foothills of the Artanus Ridge, Nona's head snapped back and what Kettle saw replaced her blindness.
"I'm neither lost, nor your sister."
Kettle ignored the woodsman, though her eyes continued to point in his direction. She drew in the halo of a peripheral vision that surrounds what we see, searching for any hint of motion. Her ears opened to every whisper of the trees, every creak, rustle, or scrape, hungry for the telltale crack of a twig. The one that allows you to see them is the distraction. The one that will kill you is hidden, waiting their moment. That was how Apple always opened the first lesson on ambush. It wouldn't take long for a novice to ask why they both didn't stay hidden and attack together.
"Because in conversation you may reveal information that they are interested in, but mainly because you will be more vulnerable with your attention on the one before you,"
Apple would say, and she would lift her hand, wriggling her fingers in a puzzling motion. At that moment, her assistant Betna, for the last few years, would rise behind the curious novice and lay a blunt knife across her throat.
"As we have demonstrated," Apple would conclude. "So where would you be heading?"
The trail behind the man lay thick with evening shadow. Kettle spared him a moment's attention. He had pallid skin, short brown hair, pale eyes. His garb was convincing enough, but it didn't suit him. The hand axe at his hip gleamed as if sharp enough to shave with. Sometimes you need to wait for an enemy to reveal himself. Sometimes you need to take the initiative. Knowing which to do and when makes the difference between those who live and those who die.
"I could give you directions."
The man seemed relaxed enough, but his questions were too pointed.
"I've been invited to dance naked for the Battle Queen," Kettle said.
A nonsensical statement can create a moment of confusion in which the Grey Sister acts. A flexing of her wrist dropped an envenomed throwing star into her cupped fingers, the edges slightly dull to avoid poisoning herself. Kettle was already turning as she released the star. She dived between the nearest trees, closing off as many angles as possible, scanning the confusion of undergrowth, the lines of the trunks, the branches interlocking against a purple-gray sky. Kettle heard the thunk of her star hitting home. She had aimed for his upper arm. There was always the chance he was simply a woodsman, and if not, she would want someone to question. Either way, she didn't want him dead. Two bolts hissed above her as she dived. Heavy bolts, not the knitting needles Nona had been hit with. The killing kind. Poor shots, though. Hunskers could move with great speed, but they couldn't fall faster than anyone else. The shot should have been on target and required Kettle to deflect them both. Crashing among the undergrowth, Kettle saw flickers of motion between the trees and not in the direction the bolts had come from. At least 5 attackers, then. Under the canopy, the light was so poor that it would leave most blundering, but pushed into darkness as she was, Kettle had no problem seeing. She scurried around the bole of the thickest tree on knees and elbows, a throwing star in each hand. They came fast, silent, knives in both hands, weaving between the pines with Hunska speed. Kettle was faster. She rose, launching herself to her feet from her knees, spinning both her stars towards the nearest 2 attackers, waiting for them to get almost close enough for blades. At a separation of 3 yards, and driven with the speed of a Hunska fullblood, Kettle's throwing stars allowed no opportunity for evasion. The left one would hit the closest woman somewhere in the neck. The right one would take the other woman in the right eye. Kettle was more accurate with her right arm. Kettle fell backward, ripping 2 of her knives from their hidden sheaths over her upper arms. Not her best pair for close work, but the easiest to reach. She let herself drop since it was likely to be the last thing her opponents expected. Unseen attacks could be coming her way, and the only defense was not to be in the place they expected her to be. The first of Kettle's remaining attackers came at a flat sprint, daggers bared, showing some skill and remarkable night vision by avoiding tripping on any root or briar. Kettle could see the confusion in the man's eyes as she fell away from him. Her outstretched foot hit his knee. He toppled forward, blade stretched out towards her, the pain from his shattered joint not yet having reached his brain. Kettle, her back thumping into the forest floor, extended her knives, points reaching for the falling man. She thrust between his arms, pushing them wider with her elbows so that his daggers drove hilt deep into the soil, missing her shoulders by an inch on each side. Her own blades punched into his neck, grating over each other as they met in his spine. Both knives came free with a spray of blood, and Kettle rolled aside. She was clear before her victim had dropped half the remaining distance to the ground. She saw the last 2 attackers closing as she twisted onto her front, facing them. Both were fast, and both had abandoned their crossbows in favor of swords. If they weren't Hunska, Kettle could have got to her feet and brought them down with throwing stars, but their speed promised they would hack her to death on her knees if she tried that. Hunskas would very rarely be shadow weavers, though. They would see little but confusion in the forest gloom. Kettle banked on their blindness and rolled to use the nearest tree as cover. Both ambushers veered unerringly towards her. Prone, the advantage of Kettle's greater speed was considerably lessened. One ambusher swung to split her head, but branches blocked the arc of his blade. The other, wise to the limitations of a long sword in woodland, thrust to skewer her. Kettle rolled onto her back again, bringing her knives up to deflect the thrust. She barely managed it, and the blade sliced through her coat before driving into the ground. In desperate straits, Kettle focused on the only opponent she could reach. Taking advantage of the momentarily trapped sword, she sliced one knife across the wrist of the hand holding it. The other she stabbed up into the man's groin. The last attacker stood, revealed as his companion doubled up, an ugly grin on his face, the point of his sword less than 2 feet from Kettle's chest. On her back, arms extended, she knew she had no real chance to avoid or deflect this thrust. But she gave no space to fear or regret, only gathered herself to try. At the back of Kettle's mind, Nona knew the nun had no hope. The man had moved with the speed of a half-blood at least. Nona, unable to help or leave or even scream, tensed for the blow. She would share the pain. It would be the last thing she could ever do for Kettle. Nona knew that even for those without Hunska blood, at the sharpest edge of things the world would slow to a crawl. It might not offer you the opportunity to act, but the inevitable happened slowly. Nona watched the point of the sword. It filled Kettle's vision, finding glimmers in the gloom. She watched the killer's face, met his stare, and knew those eyes would see the death of one of the few people she treasured, and of her last hope. When the man's face began to distort, bulging outwards, Nona could make no sense of it. When blood suffused his skin and began to erupt from eyes, nose, and mouth, both Nona and Kettle stared in vacant disbelief. Suddenly, as if their terror had released its hold on time's flow, the face exploded, and a red fist emerged from the tumbling gore. Moments later, Kettle was on her feet facing a figure so wrapped in shadow that even her dark sight struggled to make out any detail. The pair of them stood for a moment in silent regard. Kettle became aware of the moans from the groin-stabbed man by her feet, and of his hand reaching into his jerkin. She stamped on his neck, breaking it with a detachment that startled Nona. Her gaze never left the figure before her.
"Who are you?"
The darkness smoked away by degrees. The newcomer stood of a height with Kettle, clad in a raincoat.
"Sister?"
Kettle cocked her head, staring into the midnight still gathered beneath the hood. The figure made no reply, only stepped back, shaking the blood from her fingers as the last of the shadows left her.
"Zol?"
Kettle saw it before Nona did. Zol pushed back her hood. She looked at her hand in distaste and wiped it on the nearest tree.
"I do not think there are any others close by."
"Zol, what are you doing here?"
"Following you."
She blinked, as if the answer were obvious.
"Why?"
Kettle glanced around at the trees that pressed on all sides, as if expecting more novices to emerge.
"Because you are following Nona."
"How do you?"
Kettle abandoned the question in favor of.
"Why do you want to find Nona?"
"We plan to visit the ice together." Zol almost shrugged, turned away as if embarrassed. "She is the shield. I am not supposed to lose her."
"I didn't think you believed in all that Chosen One stuff."
Kettle crossed to the first two attackers and stooped to recover her throwing stars with the aid of a knife.
"I do not."
"Why then?"
The second star came loose with a wet noise. Somewhere behind Kettle, Zol spoke in a voice almost too quiet to hear.
"She is my friend."
Chapter 28. Nona clung to Kettle's thoughts, refusing to let them slip. The surge of tension that had dragged her along with their thread bond now seeped away, but a dark cell waited, and sickness. And boredom. And fear. She wanted to be with Kettle, out in the world, hunting down those who had captured her. Also, there was Zol. Between them, Kettle and Zol had dragged the supposed woodsman from the trail and off into the woods, taking him in the opposite direction to where the bodies lay. The union between Kettle and Nona was weakening. Nona could no longer hear Kettle's thoughts or touch her memories, but she could watch through her eyes, feel through her hands, and listen with her ears. It was enough. Night had fallen, and Kettle had made no fire, but both she and Zol wove shadows well enough to see in any natural darkness. Kettle secured the man to a tree using cord from her pack. She sat him with his back to it, hands tied behind the trunk. His head flopped on his chest. The throwing star had been coated with a resin based on the boneless brew that rendered its victims limp and unable to move. She removed the star from his biceps and bound the wound.
"You've punched through that man's head."
Images of the act flooded Kettle's vision. In a distant cell, Nona winced.
"I walked the path," Zol said, standing behind Kettle as she attended the captive.
"You could have just stabbed him. Or punched him more. Gently."
Kettle stood up and turned around.
"I did not know how many I would have to deal with. And I have not got a knife."
Kettle presented Zol with one of the daggers from her belt, a hefty piece of iron 9 inches long and honed to lethality.
Now you do, she smiled. And thank you.
I think he had me.
Zol said nothing, just scowled and flexed her fingers.
You've not killed someone before?
Not a question.
No.
You're right to feel it. It's not something to be taken lightly. Kettle put her hand to Zol's shoulder. The girl flinched but made no move to push Kettle away. In the distant cell, a frown creased Nona's brow. She tried to remember her first. One of Shirzal's soldiers that night in the Relum Forest. She had been 8, perhaps. She had worn the blood of those soldiers into Giljon's cage, but any trace of guilt had washed off long before.
Well,
Kettle gave Zol's shoulder a squeeze, then removed her hand.
We should find out who our friend here is and what he knows.
Kettle crouched and studied the man. The others had been similarly dressed in grey jerkins, dark trousers. Nona had little doubt they were the same order that held her captive. They had the same short hair, the same quiet dedication.
I don't really have to ask what he is, Kettle said.
He's one of the Lightless. He's shadow-threaded, like me. I can sense it now I have a moment to concentrate. You can see it in him. Now Kettle said it, Nona could see it too, and wondered how she hadn't before. The darkness moved around the man, a subtle thing, as mist would move around any other person.
Lightless? Zol asked.
The Lightless are servants of the Noi Gwyn, Kettle said. Most of them candidates who survived the training up to some point, but failed to prove themselves. They outnumber the Noi Gwyn considerably. You don't often find them out and about, though. It indicates that Nona has been captured by a Noi Gwyn. Also that either this Noi Gwyn took Lightless with him and left them to guard his trail, which seems unlikely, or that they guard this trail habitually, which would indicate that we are near the Tetragode.
Zol had no more questions. Nona had plenty, but none of her efforts to get Kettle's attention met with any success. Nobody knew where the Tetragode was sighted, though it was rumored to relocate every 2 to 4 years in any case. But wherever it was, the place would be impregnable. The Noi Gwyn had survived many enemies over the centuries, a good number of them emperors. Remaining hidden might be their primary defense, but it was far from being their only defense.
I'll give him the antidote and we can see what he has to say for himself.
Kettle reached into her pocket.
Is there any point?
Zol kicked at the ground.
He will be sworn to silence. I do not know what tortures they teach a sister of discretion, but will it be enough to break him, and quickly?
I know how to hurt someone.
Kettle's voice was grim. She took out her boning knife and used it to cut a rectangle from the bottom of the man's trouser leg, enough to cover 2 splayed hands. Next, she showed a pill between thumb and forefinger.
Antidote first.
Lifting the man's head, she put the pill into his open mouth, closed it, and raised his chin. She turned the man's head so she could stare into his eyes.
In a short while, you'll gain control over your muscles again and be able to speak.
She picked up the rectangle of cloth and waited. Control came to the man's eyes first. A twitch, another twitch, and then a frenzy of darting this way and that.
Your friends are dead, Kettle said.
Next, his mouth recovered. He spat a dark mess at Kettle, who caught it neatly in the patch she'd cut from his trouser leg. She moved back. The man kept spitting and gagging as if he had the foulest taste in his mouth. At the back of Kettle's mind, Nona puzzled. The antidote to Boneless tasted of nothing. Perhaps a little salty.
How far from here is the Tetragode?
Kettle asked.
10 miles.
The man slurred the words, his muscles still weak from the Boneless. He blinked, a
a look of horror and astonishment coming over his face. "We're looking for a girl who has been captured.